We're discussing the kind of my exegetical rules, and they're not hard and fast rules, they're rules that I made up. Everybody makes up their own set of rules for determining how they're going to read the Bible. And so tonight, I want to talk about examples. Now, I gave you some material that was put together by Roy Cogdell in a book called Walking by Faith. And if you look at the first slide, there is a link there at the bottom of that slide. You can get a hold of this book, Roy Cogdell's book, for free. It's part of it's called the Restoration Reprint Library. And just remember, it's a PDF, so when you open the book, you have to scan, because like the first three pages are blank.
Yeah.
And you think I didn't,
that. Yeah.
Yeah, you think I didn't get anything? No, it's just, you're getting there. So just hang with it. But this is pages 22 through 29 of the material that he wrote.
Yeah.
The other thing you have to understand about this material is this was all written back in the 1950s. And in the 1950s, the church was being divided over issues that related to, could churches support orphans' homes out of the church treasury? Okay. And it wasn't just orphans' homes. It was orphans' homes and colleges and publishing houses, and whether you would have a sponsoring church that would be in charge of a preacher in the Philippines and all of this. So that's the environment in which all of this was written. And so as you read through this material that Roy has written, what you'll see is references to those kinds of practices. And he was arguing that the examples that we have in the New Testament of the way that preachers were supported, the way that the churches met the needs of the church that was in famine in Judea, that those tell us how the church ought to respond to those situations. And really, the only way that you know that is by looking at examples of what they did, because there is no explicit statement, there's no real commandment to churches about how they should accomplish all of this. That comes from examples and people looking at those examples and saying those are approved examples and they tell us how we have to approach the same issues. So tonight we're going to talk a little bit about examples. And I don't know if we'll ever get, or if tonight we'll be able to get through all of this material, but you have to start with just a clear understanding that God has used behavioral exemplars to convey information to guide us. There's no question that God uses examples. I think if nothing else, you have to look at the life that Jesus led, which is an example for us. And that's what the apostle says in 1 Peter 2 at verse 21. He says it again in Philippians 2, where he talks about, let this mind be in you that was also in Christ. And then he talks about what Christ did as an example for the way that we ought to look at things. So clearly, God expects to be able to convey information to us using behavioral examples. And I think that's really why Jesus came, or one of the reasons why Jesus came here, to show us what it would look like if you lived the way that God expected you to live. And then we can imitate that. So not only do we have the information that God gives in commandments, but we also have an example of how this would look. We have to consider the behavior of godly men. And you see that in Philippians 3, in 1 Corinthians 4, a number of different places where Paul says, consider my example and follow me as I follow Christ. Okay? So he says, I mean, you look at the book of Hebrews. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken unto us by the fathers, was confirmed unto us by them that heard, or by the apostles and them that heard them? So then you have Hebrews 11, which is this long list of godly people. And he says, follow the lead of the elders. Consider their manner of life. And he wrote to Timothy, you know my manner of life and how I did things. So do them the same way. So clearly, God expects us to learn things from examples. There's no question about that. The difficulty arises when you consider all of the behaviors that people engaged in. And I think some behaviors that they engaged in are just part of the story of how they lived their life. I don't think that they are to be followed. I don't think there's any indication that we ought to do it that way. Some, yes, we need to follow. And the difficulty with examples is trying to figure out which is which. Is this just a part of the narrative story, or is it an example that I'm supposed to learn something from? Because if you think about it, every time the disciples ate the Lord's Supper, where we know where they were in an upper room. But I don't think that's an important aspect of their eating the Lord's Supper. I think that was just part of the narrative. And given what we know about the living conditions in the cities where the apostles went, typically if they were in a city, a man would have his business on the first floor of his, well, shop, residence, whatever you want to call it. And then they lived on the second floor. And even farmers, they kept their animals on the first floor and they lived in the second floor of the barn. So it was their house, their barn, it was kind of everything. And a lot of people in that period of time just lived in the second floor. So whenever the apostles or whenever the disciples would gather and they gathered in a place, it was typically in the second floor. I don't think there was any real importance to the fact that it was the second floor. So other times I look at examples and I say, those are something that we ought to follow. When Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, he used unleavened bread and grape juice. Okay? So that's why we use unleavened bread, to follow his example. And there are enough passages that talk about the leaven and how that has a lot of significance in a spiritual sense. So I conclude that it's important that we use leavened bread. Now, that is not a universally held understanding of the bread that was used in the Lord's Supper. Eastern Orthodox religions, most of the, and those that kind of descended through the Eastern Orthodox branch of the Catholic Church, use leavened bread. They use just plain old bread.
And my sister went to a congregation, Presbyterian, I think, and they use sourdough bread and wine. And I said, I think maybe we should go somewhere else.
Yeah, well, the given what we know about grape juice and storing grape juice, the way that they preserved it was to let it ferment.
Well, but sourdough bread?
Well, I'm not familiar with sourdough bread, but our practice of using unleavened bread is not universal. It's not universally understood.
Really?
Yeah.
But it is in the Church of Christ.
Yeah, within the Church of Christ, within our faith tradition, right. Okay. Yes. But Eastern Orthodox, and you know where the Eastern Orthodox came from, that was the Catholic Church that was headquartered in Constantinople instead of being headquartered in Rome. So there for a while you had two popes. You had one in Rome, you had one in Constantinople. And the Roman Church became known as the Catholic Church, the Eastern Church, the Byzantine Empire, Constantinople, became known as the Eastern Orthodox Church. And then you have other groups that descended from the Catholic Church and from the Eastern Orthodox Church. So, you know, if you went to an Eastern Orthodox worship, you'd find some things very different. Number one, you wouldn't find any chairs.
Oh, yeah. As the people that said, why would you sit before God?
Yeah, that's, and so they would never have chairs in a church building because they would consider it an insult to God that you came into his presence and then sat down. You just don't do that. So, and they use leavened bread, and they're big on iconography. This is, and it found its way into Russia, and you have the Russian iconography. So that if you went to an Eastern Orthodox church, the auditorium, what we would call the auditorium, is divided by a wall. And that wall is covered with the iconography. And the priest is the only person that goes behind the wall. Everybody else stays on this side. The priest can go on the other side of the wall.
What's iconography?
I didn't get a chance to talk with the priest about why they do that. But we did. I had a lot of conversations with a Russian Orthodox priest when I was living in Alaska because there are a lot of Russian Orthodox churches.
Oh.
Their view, you can almost always spot them because Russian Orthodox churches, when they have crosses on the top of their building, but their crosses on top of their building have the cross member that we're familiar with, the upright, the big cross member. Then at the very top, they have another little cross member, which is where they wrote King of the Jews.
Oh.
And then they have a foot rest down low, and the foot rest is always tilted to show that Jesus slumped when he died.
Oh.
So there, you can spot them when you see the Eastern Orthodox crosses. It looks different than the cross that we're familiar with.
And don't they dress differently too, or do they dress differently?
I don't know.
Well, you would know because you've been around them. I just, for some reason, I thought they were.
I don't know if all of them do, but some of the, there is a wing of the Eastern Orthodox Church that's roughly comparable to the Amish.
Yeah, that's kind of.
But the Amish, I don't know, trace their line back through the Eastern Orthodox Church. I don't know where the Amish really came from. But I'm trying to think. I have never seen Eastern Orthodox crosses on an Amish church. I don't know.
Don't they wear robes and stuff like that when they preach? Or
yeah, the priests wear a robe. Yeah. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, but the priests wear a robe in the Roman Catholic Church too.
Oh, yes.
But in the Eastern Orthodox Church, the priests do wear a long black robe. They don't wear the white collar.
Oh, okay.
So it's a little different. I just say that because people look at examples, and sometimes examples that I think are examples that we're supposed to learn something from and examples that we should follow. Not everybody believes that, or not everybody sees that in that example. And by the same token, I don't see any importance to the fact that they started with one loaf of bread. Now, there are people closer to our faith tradition who do see some importance in starting with one loaf of bread. So they take that from Jesus taking the bread, breaking it, giving it to the disciples. They probably did start with one piece of bread.
When we passed the plate, we used to break it off.
Yeah, we used to break it off. And I know some people who saw the importance of having one loaf, and so when they prepared the elements to put on the table in the morning, they put all of the containers for the bread stacked up and then one piece of bread on the top.
Oh.
And you broke that piece of bread and distributed it among all of the plates, and then individuals broke their piece off. So you did start with one piece of bread, and they perceived that that was important. Now, I don't see that, but they did. And I worshiped at a place where the just when I was much younger in Kentucky, where we started with one piece of bread. And you basically pushed your finger down in the middle of it, and it broke into four pieces, and then you distributed it to the plates, and the plates were then passed to individuals.
Oh. Were there loaves back then different than what we, because I think of ours as crackers.
No, it was probably, their loaf would have looked like our, like matzo bread, probably not as fancy square, you know.
But that was bread to them.
Yeah, that was unleavened bread. Yeah, and it was thin like that, because in order to not have yeast,
right,
leaven get into the bread, they rolled it out. It was made of just flour and water, and it was cooked immediately, so that the yeast, because there's yeast floating around in the air. So you didn't want the yeast to land on the bread and cause it to rise, so they baked it immediately, and that would kill the yeast.
I remember you saying that in a class or something, maybe in this class. I never thought about the yeast floating around in the air.
Oh, yeah. Now, typically, like when Kim makes bread, she makes sourdough bread. You do your sourdough starter with some purchased yeast, And then you keep adding, you let that yeast grow, and then you take out a little bit of it to put in the new dough that you're making, and the yeast spreads through it, and it picks up the yeast from the air. Yeah, really, that's the way that they, like when the 49ers, when the gold diggers went over Dyea Pass, they all carried a starter of sourdough.
I've done that before, but I never finished it.
Yeah, Kim makes really good sourdough bread, and it's mostly the stuff that we put in it, and you keep it alive. You have to keep feeding your sourdough starter. Okay. Well, the Jews would have gone through their houses, and they swept it clean. They eliminated all of the yeast that they could. They swept it clean, but you could never eliminate every trace of yeast because it's in the air. So you had to, in order to have unleavened bread, you had to bake it immediately. And I think it was something like within 4 minutes or something. Leave it to the Pharisees to come up with a rule for how long you could let it sit out before you had to bake it. But yeah, their unleavened bread probably looked something like ours. Not as uniform, because everybody's making it at home. So it was probably pounded out and kind of round. But I don't see any way that when Jesus took the loaf, it looked like a sourdough loaf.
Okay, that's what when you kept saying loaf.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a loaf. Sourdough or the unleavened bread is referred to as a loaf, but it would just be an unleavened loaf.
Yeah, flat.
Like, in Alaska, we used to use pilot bread. And pilot bread is like, it's kind of like hardtack.
Oh, yeah. I used to like that. I don't like that.
It's, the reason that there's no leaven in it is because it won't spoil.
No.
You can save hardtack for
forever.
Years, and it won't spoil. Just like pretzels. Nothing will attack pretzels, except humans. So some examples are considered or viewed as being exclusive, that they specify our behavior and we need to follow those examples. And it's just because they're examples, okay? So when Cogdell put this together, he came up with some rules for trying to figure out when an example needs to be followed and when it's not important. So his first rule is, he calls it the rule of uniformity. And basically it says that every time you see somebody doing something, they did it the same way. And that lends credence to, it's important that you do it that way. So if you looked at something like baptism, in the book of Acts, in the conversions that are recorded there, every person was baptized in water. Okay? And it's just an example. But because everybody did it, there had to be some reason that everybody did it the same way. Now, the Jews went so far as to say that it has to be living water, which means it has to be running water. So their mikvahs, their baptismal pools, were always built so that water ran into them and then ran out. So people would, there are people who would say, well, that's why they baptized in rivers. Those are living water. They didn't baptize in a stock tank. I don't think that that's, I don't think that the running water is in an important element. I think the important element is water.
Right. I agree.
Okay. So that's the uniformity rule. The fact that every person who accepted the word of God by faith was baptized without delay in the New Testament conversions impresses us by the very uniformity of it with the fact that such an act is essential to conversion. So he would say, everywhere you see it, that's what they did. So that's the rule of uniformity. Then there's a rule that he calls the rule of unity. This is a little bit different. Each passage of Scripture, whether it's a precept, which is what he called a commandment, or an example, must be interpreted in light of whatever and all of the other information that God has provided. So you never take a single example by itself. You consider the example in light of all of the things that happened and all of the other information that God gives about a subject, which is no different than the way that we started this class. You always consider the broader context for any statement. And that broader context ultimately means everything God said. Okay? So this rule of unity, each passage of Scripture has to be interpreted in light of whatever and all else that God has said on the subject. Which makes sense to say that baptism involves water and being immersed in water, because there is this picture of the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Christ. And so baptism is a burial. Okay? So there's all this other information that goes into understanding the force of the example. So you always consider all of the information. Next rule. Next rule is the rule of universal application. Every example that you find that is intended to be informative for our practice is something that we can do. Okay? The scope of the gospel is worldwide, and so any provision in the gospel, any example needs to be something that people can do. And it's really interesting when you look at the fruit of the vine. There is vine that grows in every place that people live. Now, it may be blackberry vines, and we're not used to using blackberry juice for the Lord's Supper, but that's still the fruit of the vine. Okay.
But is there grapes in every country?
I don't know that there are grapes in every country, but there are vines that grow.
Right, yeah.
And that's turned into juice.
Okay.
So it's not like God said you have to use red wine or red grape juice. We typically use red grape juice or Concord grapes. Okay. Is there any significance to the fact that it's purple or red? I don't think so. And I'm just snotty enough that when I was much younger, I decided to make the point by buying, instead of buying red grape juice or Concord grape juice for the week that Kim and I fixed the Lord's Supper.
You bought white?
No, I bought white grape juice.
Yeah, white. As I said, white. Yeah.
Everybody panicked because I bought white grape juice. And I shouldn't have done that. That was just being a snot.
Well, maybe, but it's still grape juice. So
yeah, still, it was still, still grape juice, but I don't think I did it.
With the right intention.
I did it out of...
You did it to cause a problem.
Yeah, I meant to be in your face.
Oh, okay.
And say...
Had somebody said to you, well, we can only use red, and that's why you bought white?
Or, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I get it now. Okay. I can
yeah.
see the
So are you saying we could use blackberry juice or raspberry juice? Are you, is that...
Yeah, it's all, what we have to do is use fruit of the vine. Okay? Now, what Jesus probably used was grape juice. Because they grew grapes. Okay? But if you lived in a place where there were no grapes, but there was another kind of vine, you could use fruit from that vine.
We experienced that in Alaska, in the native villages. They do not have access to grapevines at all. There's no grape juice.
Right.
But there are berries that grow on vines. And they can be juiced. Now, the church in Barrow, for example, chose to buy grape juice that was flown in. But had they not had that opportunity, they would have used whatever berries they could have gotten from the vines. And they were very frank about that. And they have done that. They had done that. So... Yeah, it's fruit of the vine. And I think that they were probably in the New Testament times referring to grapes and the juice of a grape because that grew proficiently in that area. So my guess would be that the reference was to grape juice.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
But I also think, but I also note that grapes are not grown on the vine in all parts of the country, but they're all parts of the world. But there are fruits that are grown on vines in all parts of the world.
Right.
Grape, but they're grown.
Right. So that's that rule of universal application. Whatever the example is, would have to be something that anybody anywhere in the world could do. Okay? And you can't think in terms of what we can do today. You have to think back to 1800. If you were living in Alaska in 1800, you couldn't just go down to the grocery store and buy grape juice that was flown in from the lower 48. If you wanted fruit of the vine, it had to be local. So, you know, I think white grape juice is fine. Now, my attitude was not.
Right.
I was just getting in your face, okay? I was being snotty and missed the whole point of the Lord's Supper to honor the Lord. So, universal application. Now, questions? Everybody good so far?
I'm still pondering the grape thing, but let's move on.
Okay.
I'll come back.
I think it's just because we're used to it.
Yes.
Yeah, we're used to it.
It might be, but if the example is grapes, I feel like it needs to be grapes. But I will. This will be good stuff for me to think about.
Yeah, if you were if you were served the Lord's Supper and when it came to you, it was white grape juice, would that give you pause?
Well, it would give me pause because I'm used to purple, but it would still be grape juice. Now, if they gave me raspberry juice,
right.
I'm not sure about that, but it gives me something to think about.
Yeah. Okay, so to say it's unleavened bread, it doesn't have to look like what we're used to. I don't know, at Canyon, where Jenny and Jeff worship, they have a lady that makes the unleavened bread, makes it fresh for every Sunday. And it doesn't look anything like ours. It's still unleavened bread. It kind of looks like an artisan pizza crust.
Oh.
It's kind of lopsided round. But that's what it is. It's unleavened bread. And we're used to buying it in the store.
Right.
So, and this stuff that we have in the containers now.
Do you ever get two? Sometimes I get two, sometimes I get three, and sometimes I get a half of one.
I've never had a half of one. I did, I think one Sunday we got two in the container that we had.
And I ate both of them. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, we have a tendency to break off a little piece, little tiny piece. And I have no idea where that comes from. That habit of breaking off a little tiny piece if the big loaf came.
Oh, if the big loaf. Well, yeah. Because you're thinking there's a lot of people
having to share.
Yeah, you have to share. So you don't want to.
Yeah.
Because I know when we broke the bread before, you know, in the container, and if you break it and it breaks a big piece, then I get embarrassed. Oh no! I break another little piece.
Yeah. Yeah. So you don't take a big piece.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know where that came from.
Yeah. It's interesting because that doesn't resemble what Jesus did with his disciples at all. You know, when they shared the Passover meal and he talked about the bread, what we do today, really, maybe the bread kind of resembles it because I think that it was more like a flat cake that they used, that they did. It looked kind of flat and like you said, kind of misshapen because it's done by hand. But the chances are that they broke off a little piece like that. I don't think that happened. I think they probably chomped on it. You know, it was a meal. They were eating a meal. And so what we have adapted for our kind of purposes in this day and age probably doesn't resemble what they did in the New Testament times at all. Not very closely anyway.
Yeah. What they did was they took the bread and then they dipped it in the salt.
Oh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jesus didn't do that when he instituted the supper. But when they took a piece of bread, it was something they could dip.
That wasn't the Lord's Supper, though.
No, but I think when they took a piece of bread for the Lord's Supper, they probably took the same kind of
piece. They may have taken a little piece. We don't
know. Yeah, we don't know.
Well, except that Jesus said, I will do this with you in my kingdom. And he was modeling the Lord's Supper at that Passover meal right before he was crucified.
Right.
I would suggest that it probably looked more like they were kind of, I mean, it sounds crude, but chomping on a piece of bread, and it wasn't just breaking off a little bitty piece and putting it in our mouths like we do today. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with what we do today at all. Not at all. But again, that's the whole point of this whole thing with example, is what is important in the example and what isn't.
Right.
So, anyway.
Right. So, I've also worshipped in a place where they used one container.
Yeah, you've talked about that. That's... that just doesn't seem kosher to me.
But there are people who see that part of the example as an important part of the example. And I don't. So when I worship with them, or if they came to worship with me, I would do it so that they could participate.
Sure. But that's putting the emphasis on the container, not the contents. How can you do that?
Well, they're saying there's, just as there was one loaf, he took one drink and he handed it to the disciples and he said, distribute this among yourselves.
So you feel like both ways are right.
I'm sorry?
You're saying that you could do several cups or one cup, both ways are right for you.
As for me, right. Yes. Okay. I don't see there's importance in the cup. I think he did it that way because he had a cup.
Right.
And he wanted everybody to have some, so he passed his cup around.
Right.
I don't think he passed, but that's, I say that because it's important for us to realize that other people look at the same behavior. And they see more importance in different parts of it.
Right.
Okay. And part of our job as Christians is to find a way to celebrate the supper so that everybody can participate. So, if you believed that we needed to do it from one container, I would find a way to do it from one container. Because I want you to be able to do it.
Yeah, but if only one person wanted to do it that way,
in my mind, this is the way we began. I still would not trample on one person's belief.
Okay.
I would find a way so that they could participate. And if they believed that we had to use one loaf, I would use one loaf and break it. Okay.
And there's things you would do that with and things you wouldn't do that with.
If it was going to prevent somebody from being able to worship, to participate in the corporate worship, there's nothing that I wouldn't do.
What if the rest of the people didn't want to do that?
Then...
isn't the majority rule?
Yeah, it isn't majority rule.
God rules. I know you know that. Yeah. I'm just thinking that when you say that, and I've heard you say that before, and I think I understand what you're saying, and I think that's great of you, but I also think that you have to say that there is things that you so believe in that there's not a choice that you wouldn't do it any other way. If somebody wanted a guitar playing up there, would you, because that made them feel that way, would you add a guitar to our service?
No.
Okay, see, that's what I mean. I mean, there's things that you can do that with, but I also think there's things you cannot do that with.
And that's determining the force of example. Okay? So, yes. There are things that I believe clearly are in the scripture, and I can't change that. Okay.
Right.
But if you believe it doesn't make any difference,
right,
whether you use one piece of bread or multiple pieces of bread, then the fact that somebody wants that, just one person understands that we ought to use one piece of bread, is enough for me to say, okay, we'll do it that way. But I would never want to be in a position of saying, is majority rule. Or that's the way we do it here. I would never do that. And if somebody believed that the baptistry needed to have running water, I would leave the water running and let it go out the drain. I would have running water. I'd find a way to have running water.
But we still do the baptism because there's people that don't.
Well,
so you can't agree with those people that don't because it specifically said
Baptists had our priorities. Yeah.
Now. Yeah, baptism, yes. Now, okay.
Sometimes these discussions are sort of this what if scenario, but I guess to Dean's defense, I do have to say we have absolutely faced these kinds of decisions, especially worshiping in remote areas in Alaska. Maybe they were unique to us because I think sort of in our Midwestern sort of a culture that we have here in this country, most of us would not be faced with those decisions, but we were faced with those decisions and we had to sort of figure out ways to work so that everybody could worship. So these are not what if scenarios in Dean's mind and in my mind, because we've been faced with them and we've had to make those decisions and we've had to decide it is not worth sort of standing on our practice so and making it so that someone else cannot worship. We are not willing to do that. I don't think that that is Christ-like, and I don't think that's what the Apostle Paul would have said for us to do. So we grappled with those things, and it was hard. So I think Dean is kind of maybe, and I don't mean to say this in a punitive way or a purgative way, but you're kind of glossing over it. We struggled with these decisions, and they were hard. But the decisions that we landed on were the ones to try to figure out ways to make everyone be able to worship with us.
Yeah, and I understand that. But I just wondered how, so you had a congregation. So did you discuss this with the congregation?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. There was no question.
No question was off limits.
Yeah, many, many discussions and many, many studies where we went really deep into the scriptures and into this kind of thing is what examples are the ones that sort of meet the criteria for us hanging on to, and what are the ones that, you know, we see them kind of like what kind of bread they used and that kind of thing as good examples for us to go by. The same thing with fruit of the vine and, you know, all of those things we really grappled with. And it was hard. It was really hard. So when Dean says, I would never do anything to keep someone from being able to worship that had this real honest conviction about what this stuff meant to them and the biblical information, I guess what I'm trying to say is it doesn't, it's not just lip service.
We lived it.
I totally believe that because you've talked about, I'm not dissing anything at
all.
Oh
yeah, no, I'm sure you're not. I guess I'm trying to vouch for him and not.
Yeah, you don't need to because we understand.
Okay.
They all know.
I'm not accusing anybody of anything. So.
I think the point that I wanted to make in my talking about what I did is that I've heard, I'm going to talk to Dean, that you have said that before. I'll just change the way I do things. And to me, I think we have to be really careful because if I didn't know you, I would think that, oh, I'll just change that. I'll just change this. You'll just change everything to please everybody else. When that's not why we're here. We're here to please God. And so in our classes,
the way you say it is, oh, if they need this, we'll do this. And I just feel like you'll change anything for anybody. But I know you. So for somebody just to hear you say that, I think they're going to think, oh, well, they'll change anything, whatever we want. Does that make sense what I'm saying or not? Well, I just feel like you're very, well, if they want to use a cup, we'll use a cup. But if I take it further to like a piano, you'll stop it there. I mean, if somebody...
Yes, but we have to have the discussion.
Right.
I want everybody to know that we can have the discussion. Yeah.
And if somebody just had to have a piano, that's the only way they could worship, would you change it?
No.
Okay. That's the only point I wanted.
No.
You make a great point, Vicki. And I think the point is you need to study it and work together. And sometimes the comments, if you make a comment in class or something, it could be taken the wrong way.
Right.
But you have to be willing to really study it and dive into it.
It's true.
And if we can question in a respectful way, then we can understand it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
By the same token, if the church here said, we're going to have a piano, and we had a discussion about it, and they were unwilling to bend on the decision to have a piano, I would go somewhere else.
Okay. Because you feel like there's a right and wrong to that.
I think the biblical information tells me not to do it, yeah.
Right. So you feel like there's, okay.
Something like this where you can have a choice that it isn't going to cause you to lose your soul. But if you go into a congregation as a guest, you should be willing to do what that congregation has set up for their group. And then...
No, if I go to a place that uses a piano...
Oh, well, no.
No, I think she's talking about
the Lord's Supper.
The Lord's Supper.
I mean, this is where I can't get my...
I think this couple, though... They were joining the church, weren't they? Or did they just visit?
No, it was when we started.
Oh,
They were a part of the group that started the church.
Oh, okay.
So.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you went somewhere and they did a one cup, you wouldn't stand up and say, I'm not doing that. You would just do it.
No,
or vice versa.
I just did it.
Yeah.
And I've done that too.
Yeah.
Cam, I wasn't dogging on Dean, and Dean, I wasn't dogging on you. I just needed a clarification.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
Of course you weren't, Vicki. I know that. I know that.
Okay.
I was just thinking, you know, when he makes these comments, I start having these flashbacks and start thinking about the time that we were in Alaska, and I think about all the great things, but I also think about all the difficulties.
Right.
And sort of the soul searching that we went through.
Did you have elders there?
No.
We had elders in the church in Anchorage, but we did not have elders in the church out in the valley where we were.
We started with this presupposition, okay, that we would do things that would allow everybody to participate. We would not so order our affairs that somebody couldn't participate. And Kim and I went on vacation, and they decided to do some things because we were on vacation, and they knew I wouldn't be there to disagree with it. And because of it, the church, we lost a bunch of people. Mm. Okay, so you can't say, I know Eileen has trouble with using multiple cups, so we're going to have a meeting to decide how we're going to do the Lord's Supper, and we'll schedule it when Eileen is on vacation.
No, that would not be proper. I mean...
But that's what they did.
Oh, wow.
That really happened to Kim and I.
That's...
We were on vacation, and they chose to do it that way. So, I've preached in churches where they used a piano, used an instrument to sing, and I said, they asked me to come and preach, and I said, can we not use the instrument? I'm willing to come and preach. Can we not use the instrument? He said, okay, that's fine.
Oh, good. That's
Now, I didn't know that that meant that we're not going to use the instrument, but you have to lead songs.
Oh.
That did not go well.
So I'm telling you, we've been through it.
And you stuck it out together, so that's important.
Yeah.
We've hung in there all these years.
And put God first, so that's good.
Okay. It's okay. In some ways we get off topic, but we're really not off topic. These are important kinds of questions that we need to answer and we need to think about. And you need to have some well thought out way of dealing with this before the situation arises.